small dog searching for aluminum cans, and he holds on tight to his dignity.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who is a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He is also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. He has an article at explorejournal.com, A Calculation of National Wellness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Hello to you, Ian.
And on this 4th of July, I wanted to explore the idea of the pursuit of happiness, which, of course, is in the Declaration of Independence. And I'm interested in where we stand in terms of our successful pursuit of happiness, because, as I mentioned in the opening, there are a lot of indexes that indicate that the country is in trouble with a growing disparity of wealth, a record number of people incarcerated, the most expensive healthcare system in the developed world with the worst outcomes, an epidemic of obesity, and a frayed social safety net under attack by billionaires and their political hirelings, who seem to be having considerable success in persuading Americans, ordinary average Americans, that they should lower their standard of living in order to free up the billionaire job creators.
Yes, it's quite amazing, isn't it? It's sort of like 1984. I recently, as you mentioned, wrote a paper on a calculation of national wellness, and I take wellness to mean that people are employed, that they feel they're fulfilling their potential, that they are physically well, that it is a national priority that they be physically well. Most of the rest of the developed world sees health as not only a right, but a national priority, since sick people aren't very good at working or creating new things. So on that basis, one of the ways one might talk about happiness is how depressed are people, since depressed people, by definition, are not happy. And if you look at the United States, what you see is a massive increase in the use of antidepressants. I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar a year business. 11% of Americans age 12 and older take antidepressant medication. I mean, just think about that for a minute. There's something like, 40 million Americans who are so miserable that the only way they get through the day is with medication. That, it seems to me, is saying that we have a country that is seriously moving in the wrong direction.
So we have a pursuit of happiness via pharmaceuticals, right? It's a false form of happiness. In fact, it's really an attempt to overcome unhappiness.
Yes, that's right. And it is particularly true with women. I mean, women are more likely to take antidepressants than men. There are about one in four women is taking an antidepressant. Anxiety treatments are used by women at almost twice the rate of men. It's the largest drug usage for women between the ages of 45 and 65 years of age. So clearly, not only are we as a country not happy, but the women in the country particularly are so miserable that about 25, just a little less than a quarter of them, feel that the only way they get through the day is, as you say, with pharmaceutical happiness.
So what explains then, given that the founding fathers, in particular Thomas Jefferson, who largely wrote the Declaration of Independence, talked about not just all men being created equal, but suggesting that we had a right to pursue happiness, after life and liberty, so that's pretty high up there in the pantheon. So right. Our political leaders today, at least in the opposition, Mitch McConnell, the Republican head of the Senate, basically on Fox News, which is hardly a liberal outlet, was repeatedly asked about what would the Republicans do about the 30 million people in America who have no health care coverage whatsoever. By the way, I think it's closer to 50 million, but let's go with the 30 million figure. And he was repeatedly asked this by Chris Wallace, and he simply refused to answer it. And eventually said, well, that's not the issue.
Yes, I mean, I saw that interview. It's quite stunning, isn't it?
Well, but what does that say about what's happened to our politics? Now, as much as you can question the sincerity of Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, maybe they wanted to protect their privileges more than anything else, but they created this foundation for a nation and this constitution that is widely revered around the world. And yet today we have politicians who simply feel that their fellow Americans don't deserve not just happiness, but they don't deserve health.
That is exactly correct. Well, my interpretation of this, and from spending years and years looking at trends, is that what has occurred is an unholy alliance between the theocrats, the conservative religious, and the corporatists and the uber-rich. It really is an unholy marriage. From the point of view of the corporatists, values issues per se don't have a lot of immediate impact on their bottom line, so they're happy to go along with whatever controlling desire the theologically conservative have. I find it very interesting that just the other day, this wonderful tour of nuns on the bus, one of the lead nuns said that the Paul Ryan budget is not, is not a moral document. So on the one side, it's useful to get the masses of people stirred up with values issues, and this is financed by the corporate right. And on the other side of it, the people who are obsessed with values issues, which interprets mostly to be willful ignorance, a kind of rejection of the world as we know it through science. And that alliance has been working for the last 30 years to breach what the founders saw as one of the fundamental protections of a democracy, and that is the separation of church and state. I mean, the thing that we don't really remember, and very few people, including a lot of historians, don't talk about, particularly historians on the right, is that the founders had very intimate and direct knowledge about what happens when church and state become entwined. Tudor history, the great war between the Protestants and the Roman Catholics that had consumed the British Isles and much of Europe for generations, was very immediate history to them. I mean, it was like our talking about the Civil War, for instance. Many of them had personal family history that involved the persecution by the state as on religious terms, or they had family members. That's almost gotten lost in our history, that people came to the New World largely because they wanted to escape the overwhelming oppression that arose when church and state became entwined. And now we have, and have had for the last 30 years, a very concerted and consistently sought goal of breaching that firewall.
Well, but my understanding is that Thomas Paine, who was in many ways the intellectual force behind the American Revolution, he, of course, was an avowed atheist because he had seen what happened in England, and he also was aware of what happened in New England with the Puritans and the witch burning. And equally so, Benjamin Franklin had experienced it firsthand. So it's not just that all of the religious zealotry was from Europe. There was some of it here, too.
Absolutely. No, that's what I'm saying, is that they recognized this to be a great sleeping catastrophe that could be awakened very easily. They were also living through the Great Awakening. I mean, at that time in the founding of the country, there was a similar kind of theocratic rightist movement that was afoot in what became the United States. But I think it is very notable and not often really discussed, certainly on the popular cable media, that sort of thing, that in the Treaty of Tripoli in 1797, in Article 11, and I'm going to quote this directly, it says, "As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion." And this was published, this was introduced into the Senate. It's a treaty. It was introduced into the Journal of Executive Proceedings of the United States Senate. It was read on the floor of the Senate twice. It was published on all of the leading newspapers of the day, and President John Adams signed it quickly. And the thing that is notable is that there is almost no recorded argument about the wording being controversial, or the fact that it was passed with a unanimous vote. It's very obvious that the idea that the government was not a Christian one was widely and easily accepted at the time. So this kind of revisionist history that we increasingly hear from the theocratic right about how America was founded as a Christian nation and all that, it's simply not true. And all of the imagery and the other stuff, you know, Washington kneeling in prayer before Valley Forge, that's a fiction. It didn't happen. The truth of the matter is that the founders understood that religion prospers best when it and the state are completely separated, and that the state similarly also profits.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute, and he's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. And he has an article at explorejournal.com, A Calculation of National Wellness. And we're exploring the notion in the Declaration of Independence of our life, liberty, and in particular the pursuit of happiness, and how far we have achieved that goal in America today. And you're suggesting that the most malignant form of that's creating this unhappiness, if you will, is coming from the religious right. But so much of what is coming from the religious right is a form of magical thinking that is the antithesis of economic and political reality, to my mind. I mean, if you believe, you know, as some of the televangelists, Osteen, the fellow down there in Texas, who's the most popular televangelist of the day, he's a proponent of the prosperity gospel. And of course, he prospers because he continually asks for money from his flock. But the long and the short of it is that his mantra is, God wants you to be a winner, not a whiner. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is that so many Americans do not engage in political action and activity, and do not recognize that their political and economic health is tied to their political participation, and they're either waiting to win the lottery or waiting for Jesus Christ to come back.
Yeah, well, it's not just the religion part. You have to also, Ian, I think you have to also see it and its linkages with the corporatist right. I mean, they mutually support one another for reasons which, were they to achieve their goals, would place them in opposition. But at the moment, they have made, as I say, this kind of unholy alliance. My concern, and the thing that I spend actually a fair amount of time doing, looking at trends, is that using any measure of science, and I could, you've listed a bunch in the introduction, I could give you a half a dozen more, the correlation of violence, for instance, of spousal abuse, all of that, which arises when the these red value situations obtain in states as opposed to the what I would call the blue value states. I mean, the difference between the red value states and the blue value states, for instance, Washington, Oregon, compared to Louisiana, Mississippi, is so extraordinary when you actually look at the science. I mean, the point that I'm trying to make, and I think the 4th of July is a very good time to make it, is when we speak in terms of national wellness, national happiness, which is, as you point out, a fundamental statement of the founding documents, and we measure the social outcomes that arise from different kinds of policies, it becomes very clear that these corporatist, theocratic right policies produce miserable social outcomes. So the difference is so great that I wonder that we shouldn't post signs on the borders of red states saying living in these states may be inimical to your health.
Well, the statistics are pretty clear that these states that pride themselves on their Christian values and their family values have the reverse, you know, in terms of the Christian document, the Bible, and the prophet Jesus. He was mostly about taking care of the poor and the downtrodden, and he had pretty much contempt for the wealthy. So that's out the window because you know everybody's following the prosperity gospel. You have the highest divorce rates in some of these red states. I think Mississippi's got the highest in the country. And I think more importantly, it's the connection between this religious fundamentalism and this anti-intellectualism and this anti-science movement in this country that I find alarming, that essentially, you know, is a form of American medievalism. It's the very stuff that we're sending our boys and girls over to Afghanistan to fight the Taliban for, you know?
Yes, I think you're correct in this. I do want to make one thing really clear, and I believe that you probably agree with me on this. This is not an argument about that, an anti-Christian argument. Because if you actually read the fundamental documents of Christianity, that's why I like this Nuns on the Bus tour, because the nuns really believe Jesus, and they actually work to implement the things that he said, which is, as you treat the least, so you're treating me, go forth and heal. Well,
Stephen, I've had Sister Simone Campbell on a couple of times, and I had her on just a week ago when she was on the bus the day that she had gone to Representative Ryan's office in Wisconsin. So we've had her on this program. It's saying exactly what you're saying.
Yes, I mean, those are people who are living Christian values. That's the thing I want to be very clear about. This is not an anti-Christian argument. If people lived actually the real Christian values that Jesus taught, we would have a very different, I mean, for instance, we would have universal health care, for instance. We would have universal education, because all of those things are designed to fulfill the mandates that Jesus left his followers. I mean, he says, as you love God and you love your neighbor as yourself, and that is the whole of the law and the prophets. So, I mean, this is not complicated. What we have instead is not Christianity. It's something that calls itself Christianity, but that in fact is a system, an approach to social policy, which is designed to create elites. It is designed to allow the manipulation of the system so that those who have more, and those who have little have less. And you can see the results of that across the United States in 100 different ways, from the fact that we have 17 million children that go to bed hungry during the course of a year. I mean, think about that for a minute. Little children in a country which throws away billions of dollars of food just into dumpsters, and we have millions of children who go to bed without full tummies or without anything in their tummy. We have women dying because they can't get the most basic kind of health services. That is not a Christian country. And I think that it's the difference. We need to stop looking at religion through the lens of its divinity and instead look at it through the reality of its social policies. And when you look at it that way, it's very clear that the teachings of Jesus and the source of Christianity and the reality that we're facing have very little to do with one another.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and resume the conversation with Stephen Schwartz.
A purple mountain majesties over the fruited plain. But now wait a minute, I'm talking about America.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz. Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute. He has an article at explorejournal.com, A Calculation of National Wellness, and we're talking about the Constitution's invocation to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and how much we've achieved or succeeded in our pursuit of happiness. But that's not to say that in these red states that religious people are in any way not Christian. I mean, statistics are pretty clear that a lot of Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals in this country are quite generous. They give more to charity. They act that they have. They try to feed the poor and stuff.
They give money mostly to their churches.
Right, they do. But
that is quite different than giving in an ecumenical sense to foundations that, for instance, like Feeding America, which are these non-religious public service foundations that just take on everyone. They provide services. But the deeper question,
wait a second, you dropped out there. You've got to repeat that. But the deeper question.
But the deeper question, I think, is why, given that our foundational documents puts happiness in the first paragraph of the statement, why have we strayed so far from life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that we have the largest incarceration rate in the world, 5% of the population of the world and 25% of its prisoners? Why do we have the highest infant maternal mortality rate in the industrialized world? More mothers die, more babies die. Why do we have, according to the World Health Organization, a health system that is down I think it's 37th this year. I mean, why is that happening when the foundation says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? I think that's the fundamental question we ought to be asking ourselves on this 4th of July, because the answers that we're going to make to those challenges, the programs that we're going to develop are going to determine the history of America in the future. And I think many of the founders, Franklin, Washington, Madison, Monroe, Mason, would be Adams, would be appalled at the choices that are now being made.
So what then is the explanation for this usurpation of the Founding Fathers and of patriotism by the Tea Party? And why hasn't this fraud been exploded, that their version, their libertarian version of the American document, of the Declaration of Independence, is an abomination? It has nothing to do with, this is not a country that's predicated upon survival of the richest.
Well, I think there are several major critical leverage points. One is this marriage between the theocratic right and the corporate right. That's one thing. The Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, which has essentially legalized bribery. I mean, nobody gives $10 million without expecting something in return. So the fiction that these vast sums of money that have poured into this election, you know, what was it, 119 people basically financed the Republican, 82% of the Republican primary. That wonderful quote Nancy Pelosi had, 119 people, why don't we just ask those people what they want? That, I think, the combination of the linkage of the corporate right and the theocratic right and the opening of the floodgates of money as a result of Citizens United and the systematic programs to make people ignorant, willful ignorance. I mean, the Gallup organization just published their latest poll on a thing they have been studying since 1991, and that's the belief in creationism, and they it has been growing, and their latest report says that 46% of Americans believe that the world was created within the last 10,000 years with all of the species pretty much as they are today, no evolution. To believe something like that and to foster something like that, and there are active programs to introduce into the states. This is really being done at the state level, through organizations like ALEC and other similar rightist organizations to rewrite history, to teach science as if science were just another ideology, that these false equivalencies that are created between creationism, for instance, and evolutionary science on the other, as if they're having an argument and they're both equals. That's a completely inaccurate and wrong perspective. Creationist science has nothing. There's about 400 words that come out of the Bible that on one side and all of science on the other side, and yet they are treated as if they are equals. This rise of willful ignorance where people cannot get good information. You don't get it in school. It's appalling. I mean, something like 60% of the American public can't tell you how many Supreme Court justices there are. Another large percentage can't even tell you the branches of government. I mean, we have a population which is increasingly ignorant and which is increasingly influenced by vast sums of money which are spent not in the purpose of creating national wellness, but of creating willing sheep who will participate against their own self-interest. And I think it is something that on the 4th of July we ought to think very deeply about.
Well, just in closing Stephen Schwartz, do you believe that this current Republican Party that's not the Eisenhower Party anymore. And you've I think, made a case that the current Republicans are largely a coalition of corporatists and Christian fundamentalists. Have they made an investment in ignorance, and is it going to pay off for them in 2012?
Well, we can absolutely say without contradiction that, yes, they have made an investment in willful ignorance. Is it going to pay off? We're going to find out in November. And this election, I know everybody says it's a commonplace, this is the most important election, blah, blah, blah. Well, I think this is the most important election of our lifetimes, because it is going to set in motion policies and programs which are going to shape us in 100 different ways. We haven't even touched on climate change and the theocratic corporatist rights opposition to climate change and the millions of dollars spent to obscure and obfuscate the issue. I mean, that's a whole other program. But this rise of willful ignorance and the linkage of the corporatists and religious rights and the passage of Citizens United collectively, I think, place us at a fulcrum where our future is going to be decided in November. And I think, again, all I can say is it's the 4th of July. We need to think very deeply and carefully about the kind of world we'd like to have and we'd like our children and grandchildren to grow up in.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here on the 4th of July, Stephen Schwartz.
Thanks so much, Ian. You have a great 4th.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate in cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. He has an article at explorejournal.com, A Calculation of National Wellness. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.